This was tragic. It was awful. And there's no minimizing the pain of the families that have lost babies.
Historic flash flooding in central Texas claims the lives of more than 120 people, with many more still missing. The Catholic Archbishop of San Antonio and the laity talk about the way forward in the face of grief. The unspeakable tragedy for one family, two young sisters killed in the flood. We talked to a Texas priest providing spiritual counsel to parishioners who lost not only their daughters, but two grandparents as well. From a Catholic perspective, after much celebration at the White House over the signing of the One Big Beautiful Bill of tax cuts, an in-depth look at the spending bill, positives on pro-life issues and negatives on serving the poor and marginalized. And Catholicism at Canterbury. Our cameras are in England to capture details of a historic Catholic Mass at the famed Anglican Cathedral. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Bad things have happened to our community. And where do you go? In your heart, you have to go somewhere intangible, somewhere spiritual, somewhere at the core of what it means to be a human.
The tragedy is unthinkable, the loss unimaginable, and the death toll keeps rising. 1 week after a wall of water rushed through the Texas Hill Country along the Guadalupe River, taking with it people, animals, vegetation, and property in one of America's worst flash flood events in decades. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Sadly, an army of rescue workers has transitioned to recovery mode as they search for the remains of flood victims in piles of debris that have swept miles downstream. Authorities confirm more than 120 deaths and say more than 160 people are still missing. While the scope of tragedy crosses all communities, Texas Catholics have also been deeply affected. Reporter Roselle Regis begins our coverage.
What now? You know, what am I going to do now? I don't know.
I couldn't sit back. I mean, it ate at me all day yesterday and seeing everything.
Destruction and devastation. Texans are still reeling from tragedy after record-breaking flash floods ravaged communities along central Texas in the early hours of July 4.
They would not be able to express it verbally, but you were able to see in their eyes, in their faces, in their bodies, they were carrying a lot of sorrow and also fear.
On the ground, San Antonio Archbishop Gustavo Garcia Sierra and Auxiliary Bishop Michael Boulette traveled to Kerrville to minister to the victims of the flooding.
Our Archbishop and our Auxiliary Bishop and our new priest that was just installed this last Sunday were all out on Friday at the Ingram Elementary Reunification Center, greeting parents, consoling parents.
Archbishop Garcia Sierra said he encountered many people who were scared and who welcomed prayers as they face an uncertain future.
Accompany them, that was the most important piece, to be there. And so you embrace, you touch their hands, you look at them, you listen to them, because there are no words.
On Sunday, July 6, a memorial mass was held at Notre Dame Catholic Church in Kerrville, the town at the heart of the destruction, to bring comfort to grieving families and Hill Country communities. Other faith communities of the Texas Hill Country have also held masses, rosaries, and memorial services for flood victims.
This trauma is something that everybody is experiencing and living through in some way. That will live with everybody to some degree or another for the rest of our lives.
Camp Mystic, a nearly century-old all-girls Christian summer camp with its picturesque grounds, as shown on its website before the tragedy, was one of the worst-hit sites. The camp lost at least 27 campers and counselors, as well as longtime camp director Dick Eastland. After a service at St. John the Divine, an Episcopal church with deep ties to the Camp Mystic community gathered on the lawn outside of the church, forming a large circle and singing camp songs. Several Camp Mystic alumni spoke to Catholic News Agency senior editor Amira Abu Zaid about what Camp Mystic has meant to generations of Christian women in Texas.
It's made us who we are. It's how we live our life with the things that we learned at camp.
Alumna Alifair Hotzi and her 10-year-old daughter, who is a recent camper at Camp Mystic, are praying for the camp and hope to see it rebuilt someday.
All of our little girls are asking when they get to go back to camp, even still.
Teen camper Finley Houston, who has been going to Camp Mystic every summer for the past 6 years, feels the same way.
It's just an amazing place, and I really hope that they're going to be able to recover and open back up so everyone can keep experiencing it.
Camp Mystic has released a statement posted on its website. We ask for your continued prayers, respect, and privacy for each of our families affected. May the Lord continue to wrap His presence around all of us. Roselle Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
In the aftermath of the devastating floods, local officials in Kerr County face mounting questions over their emergency warning system and whether they could have done more to alert people ahead of the tragedy. During daily news conferences, Kerr County officials evaded questions on their emergency warning system after many residents say they received either alerts too late or no alerts at all. The River Valley has a history of deadly floods. In 2015, Kerr County debated installing a flood monitoring system and warning sirens, but later abandoned the idea due to budget concerns and opposition from some residents. State lawmakers will discuss flood warning systems later this month during a special legislative session. Faithful around the world have offered their prayers for the victims of the floods. During his Sunday Angelus, Pope Leo XIV shared a special message in English, offering his own prayers for those affected.
I would like to express sincere condolences to all the families who have lost loved ones, in particular their daughters who were at summer camp in the disaster caused by the flooding of the Guadalupe River in Texas in the United States. We pray for them.
There's been story after story of faith and resilience that have come to light these past few days. One story of a strong sisterly love until the end has especially captured people's hearts amid tragedy. Two of the flash flood victims were sisters Blair and Brooke Harbor, ages 13 and 11. The Harbor girls were students at a Dallas Catholic school and were vacationing with their parents and grandparents on the Guadalupe River near Hunt, Texas, when the floods took their lives. Their grandfather, Mike, was also killed, and their grandmother, Charlene, is presumed dead. According to the family's GoFundMe page, Blair and Brooke were found with their hands locked together, and they had their rosaries with them. Their aunt says she just had a conversation with 13-year-old Blair about God and heaven 2 weeks earlier. Joining us now is the Harbor family's pastor, Father Joshua Whitfield of the St. Rita Catholic Community in Dallas, Texas. Father, thank you for speaking with us during what I imagine must be one of the heaviest weeks of your priesthood. I first need to ask, how is the Harbor family doing right now? What can you share with us?
Thanks for asking and thanks for having me and thanks for that question. The Harbors are day by day, moment by moment. They are an amazingly strong family of faith. The Catholic faith for them is the air they breathe. It's their daily strength, and it's proven itself strong this week. But it is day by day, moment by moment for them.
Father, tell us, what do you think the legacy of Blair and Brooke will be, and their grandparents, Mike and Charlene?
Brightness, fun, The girls were part of us. It's a huge parish, a huge school, and they were in the middle of it. Annie, their mom, is a teacher at our school, and you know, they served at Mass, and I mean, look at the smiles, you know. I mean, that's their legacy, reminding us not to take for granted the beauties that God gives us in each other. That you know, you really should love the people close to you and hug them tight and not take them for granted. And we're talking about that a lot, mm-hmm. People here at St. Rita this week.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And Father, I understand there were other families in your parish community impacted by these Texas floods as well. How much did the flooding in Hunt, Texas impact the St. Rita Catholic community in Dallas, which is hours away?
Well, you know, as I've been telling people, anybody who is a real Texan knew instantly the moment they saw the headline that it was going to affect so many people across the state, because that is summer camp central. And hundreds and thousands of kids and families are on that river in the summer. And so in our parish, we've got about five families who were impacted in different ways. And I've been on the phone. I was on the phone just an hour ago with another family. They're boys in our school. They lost their cousin. And you know, it's I've never seen anything like it. And it is beautiful, though, to how those families who are grieving in their own different ways are coming together and asking after one another. We're all saying to ourselves, we have no idea how we could get through this without each other, without the church. Mm-hmm. And so it's painful and beautiful at the same time.
Father, you yourself, you've had quite the journey to the Catholic priesthood. Just so our viewers know, you are a married former Episcopal priest and the father to five children. Mm-hmm. You were ordained a Catholic priest in 2012 through St. John Paul II's provision for the reception of Episcopal clergy into full communion with the Catholic Church. Father, how has your specific, unique vocation as a married priest, how has that shaped the way that you're now pastoring to your flock amid this tragedy? I mean, you yourself, you have young daughters.
Right. In fact, Zoe Catherine had Miss Harbor for a teacher. And ZC, we call her Zoe Catherine. I just saw her before I came on with you. She was in Brooks grade. And so, yeah, it's been a challenge. As I've said to others, sometimes it's a weakness, sometimes it's a strength, mm-hmm. because, you know, as a shepherd, as a pastor, as a priest, you have to serve totally your people. But then there are those moments when you feel it as a dad, you know, and it hurts. And I know how these dads are feeling. We're looking at each other, trying to hold it together, because we know what it's like to have a little girl in our arms, you know, And so, yeah, it's I pray to God that He allows me to use that for good, mm. you know, that experience of a father's pain, because we all have it, that's mm-hmm. for sure.
Can you talk specifically about how there's a Texan response to this tragedy? How have you seen the faithful in the state of Texas rally together during this time?
Well, it's beautiful. I am a proud Texan, you know, and it is, God bless me with being a Texan. And I just see the goodness of ordinary people, Catholic and Protestant, the Catholic Church in Texas. Father Raphael is this priest who helped the Harbors down in Hunt, Texas, and he's coming up for the funeral on Monday. And we Catholics have just come together to help, and from food to laughter to a shoulder, you know, I'm thank God I'm a Catholic in Texas, because it's just beautiful how we've rolled up our sleeves and taken care of each other. The bishop here in Dallas has been such a pastor to me and to us. I'm proud.
Mm. Father, can you briefly tell us more about Camp Mystic? It was a Christian camp, not a Catholic camp, but it seems a lot of Catholics were there.
Yes, ma'am. Camp Mystic is one of the great camps along that river, Camp Waldemar and another. As I said, that's Summer Camp Central, and we've had St. Rita girls going there forever. And one of our parishioners, Avery, she is a St. Rita graduate and graduate of Ursuline Academy and in college now. She was a counselor and rescued kiddos until she herself had to be rescued. And I've been texting with her about how proud I am of her. And she is the one who told me that you know, Camp Mystic would provide Mass for the Catholics there, you know. And so it was a beautiful place of charity between Catholics and Protestants. You know, when you see that video, those girls singing Amazing Grace, you know, there's Catholic kids on that bus singing it, you know, and it's just beautiful.
It's so beautiful. And Father, I just want to thank you again for speaking with us. Please be assured of our prayers for your parish and for the Harbor family in particular.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
We continue our conversation about how to move forward in faith amid grief and tragedy in Texas, as I'm joined now by a licensed professional Catholic counselor. Anthony Flores is a clinician at Divine Mercy University, a Catholic graduate school of psychology and counseling. He is a clinical traumatologist and has traveled to respond to traumatized persons in the immediate aftermath of disasters, including 2017's Hurricane Maria and the Chico, California wildfires. Anthony, thank you so much for being here, because there is a lot to process. There's a lot of trauma surrounding this story, and it's hitting different people at different levels. You have the survivors, you have victims' families, and you have the everyday American who's consuming this news right now. So I want to first address those young campers who survived the floods in Texas. If you were there on the ground in Texas, what might you expect to see in meeting with these young survivors?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me here. It's an honor. It's a tragedy that we have to be talking about these things right now, though. But they're on the ground, right? They're in Texas. Those who are struggling through this disaster, there's a lot to contend with, a lot of grief. A lot of trauma as well. And so because of that, there's going to be a lot of different reactions that people are having. And there's a lot of overlap between adults and children in terms of how they are going to be responding to this trauma. For the children in particular, though, is we really want to, you know, wrap our arms around them, right, and protect them as much as we can. And so what we want to be looking for with them are, you know, are they having more nightmares? Are they having more regressive type of behaviors, thumb sucking, bedwetting, things like that? They can exhibit anxiety and fear in different ways than us adults. They don't quite have the language to express things that we do, and so that can look like you know, stomach aches, headaches, things like that.
That absolutely makes sense about how it's processed differently at different ages. Tell me about vicarious trauma. What is that, and who might experience that in this case?
So many. First responders, clergy, therapists who are there, parents, community members, anyone can be experiencing that vicarious trauma. And what we mean by vicarious trauma is maybe I haven't experienced it myself directly, but I know of somebody close to me who did, or I am seeing it on TV, or I'm seeing it, you know, the aftermath of what has happened. And so what we mean by that is if I'm continually taking in all of this trauma that I'm seeing or hearing from others, then I can begin to experience trauma reactions myself as well. And that can even lead into experiences of PTSD.
Anthony, when there is such a tragedy like this one, people might have a crisis of faith and be asking, why God did this happen? As a Catholic counselor specifically, what do you want to say to people who are really grappling with God amid such tragedy?
Sure. Well, I want them to know that that's such a normal experience. I mean, it really is. To have something so abnormal and devastating occur like that, it really shakes up one's understanding of reality. And that's essentially what trauma is. Mm-hmm. And so in the aftermath of trauma, reality is kind of broken, and sometimes that is our perception of God. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, logically, we can understand maybe what our church teaches us, right? That God allows bad things like this to occur, mm-hmm. and he can bring out a greater good. Logically, we might be able to understand that. Mm-hmm. But effectively, in the heart, that might be a more difficult mm-hmm. thing to really understand. And so I think it's in that way we really have to pour ourselves out to God and, mm-hmm. and wrestle with him in a mm-hmm. sense. Let him know what we're feeling.
Anthony, there's a lot more I could speak to you about, but I'm so grateful for your time and for your guidance with us this week in particular. Thank you. Yeah,
thank you so much.
If you feel compelled to help Texas flood victims as they try to recover from last weekend's devastation, contact Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of San Antonio or Catholic Charities of Central Texas. Their information is on the screen. Both organizations have taken on 7 different Central Texas counties each and will direct help to where it is most needed. There's much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Next, a Catholic perspective on the One Big Beautiful Bill with the national president of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, USA.
As Pope Leo holds private talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at Castel Gandolfo, is the Trump administration having second thoughts about Russia's Vladimir Putin? We'll explain.
It's a fantastic occasion to be able to celebrate the Roman Catholic Mass here in this magnificent cathedral, the heart cathedral of the Anglican denomination.
And EWTN News in Depth is present for a historic event this week at Canterbury Cathedral. We'll be right back.
President Donald Trump triumphantly signs the One Big Beautiful Bill at the White House on July 4th, surrounded by Republican congressmen as they celebrate his package of tax breaks and spending cuts. The bill was the president's highest domestic priority and could be the cornerstone of his second-term legacy. But it doesn't come without controversy. Critics call the tax cuts a giveaway to the rich that will rob millions of low-income people of health insurance and food assistance. And resulting deficits, they warn, will threaten America's financial stability. Reactions from Catholic leaders have been mixed.
On this vote, the yeas are 218, the nays are 214. The motion is adopted.
In an almost straight party line vote, Republicans completed their top legislative priority of this Congress, passing President Trump's tax cut and spending bill. It provides $4.5 trillion in tax cuts over the next 10 years and makes permanent the 2017 tax cuts from his first term. It boosts funding to deport illegal immigrants and increase national defense spending. House Speaker Mike Johnson says it will make the country stronger, safer, and more prosperous. And President Trump says tax cuts will spur growth. But the new bill will also balloon the national deficit, resulting in nearly $3.5 trillion in future deficits over the next 10 years, according to calculations from the Congressional Budget Office. To offset the debt, it will cut into safety net programs for the poor, with major cuts to Medicaid and food stamp assistance. Many leading economists call the One Big Beautiful Bill short-sighted and dangerous, saying it will cause inflation, higher interest rates, the risk of recession, and stagflation. Here's former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers.
And for what? $1 million over 10 years to the top 0.1% of our population. Is that the highest priority use of federal money right now? I don't think so. This is a shameful act by our Congress and by our president that is going to set our country back.
Catholic leaders have both praised and criticized the legislation. Pro-lifers celebrated the big, beautiful bill's defunding of Planned Parenthood for 1 year.
Just got news that Planned Parenthood was just defunded. Clinics that kill babies will likely shut down because of this.
Planned Parenthood was just defunded for 1 year of $500 million of our taxpayer dollars. Big deal. Babies are going to be safe.
The provision dropped a 10-year defunding proposal down to 1 year. And though the new law does not mention Planned Parenthood by name, the legislation bans Medicaid users from coverage with a healthcare practice providing abortions. Planned Parenthood says that means nearly 200 of its facilities may be forced to close and sued the administration almost immediately to try to block enforcement. And in what's being called a strong pro-family measure in the bill, the child tax credit saw a slight bump from $2,000 per child to $2,200.
This is a permanent increase that is indexed to inflation every year going forward. This is a much more stable setting for parents who need the CTC to take care of their kids.
But Catholic leaders also say the One Big Beautiful Bill tears at America's national social safety net. Archbishop Timothy Broglio, the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, released this statement. The final version of the bill includes unconscionable cuts to health care and food assistance, tax cuts that increase inequality, immigration provisions that harm families and children, and cuts to programs that protect God's creation. The bill, as passed, will cause the greatest harm to those who are especially vulnerable in our society.
A leading Catholic aid group combating homelessness says the Big Beautiful Bill will have an unprecedented and devastating effect on the poor. The president of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul USA, John Barry, said, quote, "The budget reconciliation bill is one of the most distressing laws we can remember when it comes to heeding God's call to care for the poor, the sick, and the aged. Make no mistake about it. Whatever else this new law does, the changes to SNAP and Medicaid will hurt men, women, and children by stripping away food and medical benefits that they rely on to survive. The rich will get richer. The poor will get poorer." John Barry joins us now. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul USA, which he leads, has nearly 90,000 volunteers serving those in need in parishes across the U.S. John, welcome to the program. First, the St. Vincent de Paul Society is not partisan and does not often speak out on policy issues. Why speak out on the Big Beautiful Bill? Why now?
Well, we have begun an advocacy campaign that actually began about 2 years ago when I became president of the society. Advocacy is part of our DNA. It was part of the founding of the society in 1833 by Blessed Frederick Ozanam in Paris. And he talked deeply and profoundly about the fact that it's not just charity, but it's justice. Hmm. And one of his most famous quotes is one of my favorite quotes, is that charity is the Samaritan that pours oil on the wounds of the traveler, but it's justice that prevents the attack in the first place. Hmm. So the society has an obligation to speak out about the things that we feel need to be addressed. As you mentioned, we have 90,000 volunteers mm-hmm. who go out and sit face to face last year with 5 million people across mm-hmm. the United States. Mm-hmm. We're the only organization, the only nonprofit that does that face to face human Christ-centered interaction. And we gather a lot of information from that, and we need to be able to inform our legislators, inform our leaders in this country about issues mm. surrounding that.
Well, that being said, you are on the front lines serving those in need. So put it into perspective for us. What is the state of poverty in the U.S. right now, and how do you foresee this new law playing a factor in our poverty levels moving forward?
Poverty in the United States right now is at one of the worst levels it's been since it's been recorded. Homelessness in 2004 was measured in January in the annual count, nationwide count, at 770,000 people. That's an increase from 2002 of 32.5%. And it's the highest level of homelessness that has ever been recorded since the count began in 2007. There are a lot of reasons for that. Mm. The affordability crisis of housing, wage stagnation, the limitations on benefits across the, across the nation. So we have seen a surge for the last number of years in people coming to us for support, for food, for housing, for medical bills, for their utilities. The jobless situation, the fact that there are jobs, the unemployment rate is low, but the unemployment rate is low for those people that have skills and those people who have the ability to access well-paying jobs. The lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, where you have people that are trying to find jobs that are things that they can do, that's hard for them. And they find them, they're not jobs they can survive on. You know, try to live on the minimum wage.
That's all such important context given this conversation. I do want to get your response to this. The Big Beautiful Bill requires able-bodied, childless adults between the ages of 18 and 64 to work at least 80 hours a month to be eligible for Medicaid benefits. You can also be eligible through community service, going to school, engaging in a work program. And John, the White House says by doing this, the bill actually strengthens the integrity of Medicaid by eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse. So what's your response to those who say this work requirement for Medicaid, it's a good thing. It's good to get back to work, and there's actually dignity in work?
There is dignity in work, and it's part of Catholic social teaching. The dignity of work is one of the most important criteria of Catholic social teaching. The problem with the way the bill is structured is that the work requirements, the volunteer requirements that are in the bill in order to access Medicaid and SNAP are designed in a way that makes it a challenge for the people that are on those programs now to stay on them if they are outside of any kind of normative state of being. So take, for example, someone who is an elderly person caring for an even more elderly parent, a caregiver, a what you might call an off-the-radar caregiver, taking care of them in their home, that person can't go and work because who's going to take care of the person in the home? Now, the bill says, oh, well, you can get exemptions for stuff like that. That's a challenge for people to go and do that.
Finally, my last moment with you, John, have you had the chance to have communication or the St. Vincent de Paul Society have communication with the Trump administration? Or what do you hope to communicate to the administration?
We haven't had direct communication with the administration, but I was up on Capitol Hill last month. I spent quite a bit of time with a number of the members of Congress. I sat, had a very good meeting with the chairman of the Agriculture Committee. I met with a number of the, I met with a number of the staff from a number of the committees. We laid out our positions and we laid out our thinking behind it. We heard their positions. It was a respectful and open dialogue. We'll continue to provide real world examples to them of how people are impacted by this.
Well, we appreciate your work and we appreciate your time today. John Barry, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Important news headlines are next in the Week in Review. President Trump changes his tune on Vladimir Putin. Tariff deadlines go down to the wire and no relief from the Supreme Court for thousands of fired federal workers. We'll be right back. A tense series of weeks are ahead for the global economy. That news tops the week in review. This as the Trump administration sends out a series of tariff letters to countries around the world demanding new trade agreements. And a new round of tariffs announced this week, the Trump administration sent letters to multiple countries announcing tariffs ranging from 20% to 50% will be charged on goods imported from those countries starting August 1st. This is a change of what was announced in April when President Trump said he planned to negotiate full trade deals with 90 countries in 90 days. But this week, calling such negotiations too, quote, time-consuming, he said it was easier to send letters announcing his chosen tariff rate.
This is a globalized effort to reset U.S. trade in a way that's beneficial to the United States, and not just in dollars and cents, but also in our own domestic industrial capacity. So this has been made clear to countries around the world. We were coming up upon upon the middle of this month, and the markets demand certainty, and so these letters set a baseline.
But those letters were not so warmly received around the world. In Brazil, thousands protested the Trump-proposed 50% tariff on Brazilian imports. And Brazil's president rejected Trump's claim the U.S. is running a trade deficit with Brazil, citing U.S. government statistics showing a U.S. trade surplus of hundreds of billions of dollars over the last 15 years. President Trump hosted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House this week, hoping to move forward a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. The two leaders met twice this week at a White House dinner on Monday and for a private conversation on Tuesday. Their talks centered around a proposed 60-day ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, which would require Hamas to release some of its remaining hostages in exchange for some of Israel's Palestinian prisoners and increased access to aid. Talks have been stuck at the negotiating table for months, and Trump says both sides of the conflict need to make concessions. But Netanyahu emphasized to reporters he and the U.S. are united in their goal to end Hamas's rule in Gaza.
In pursuing this common goal, we have a common strategy. Not only do we have a common strategy, we have common tactics. This doesn't involve pressure, doesn't involve coercion. It involves full coordination.
The two allies also touted their combined efforts to strike Iran's nuclear sites in late June. As a sign of goodwill toward Trump and his efforts for peace in the Middle East, Netanyahu surprised him with a letter formally nominating him for a Nobel Peace Prize, a distinction the president has long hoped to receive.
We get a lot of thrown at us by Putin, for you want to know the truth. He's very nice all the time, but it turns out to be meaningless. Putin is not, treating human beings right. He's killing too many people.
And a change in tone from the White House about Russian President Vladimir Putin and his war of aggression against Ukraine. In rare direct criticism of Putin, President Trump expressed impatience with the Russian leader and his unwillingness to agree to a ceasefire. The Pentagon had briefly paused arms shipments to Ukraine last week, surprising Ukraine, many U.S. lawmakers, and the White House itself. But the president reversed that move, saying Ukraine must be able to defend itself. With Trump's potential approval, Congress is now seriously weighing punishing new sanctions against Russia. Pope Leo hosted Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for a private meeting on Wednesday, where he reiterated his closeness to the people of Ukraine. The two discussed the necessity for dialogue between Ukraine and Russia, and the Holy Father once again offered to welcome representatives from the two countries to the Vatican for negotiations. Pope Leo is spending two quiet weeks of vacation at Castel Gandolfo. The estate has been a getaway for popes for centuries, a tradition Pope Leo has rekindled to the delight of locals after the late Pope Francis decided during his pontificate to remain in Rome for his summers. In a break from decades-long ban, the IRS says churches and houses of worship can endorse political candidates. In a court filing released on Monday, the Bureau called the endorsements a private matter between clergy and congregation, comparing it to a family discussion. A 1954 amendment in the U.S. tax code prevents churches and other tax-exempt organizations from political campaigning, though the IRS has rarely targeted places of worship for violating this rule. The Supreme Court this week paved the way for the Trump administration to fire tens of thousands of federal workers. In a brief unsigned order on Tuesday, the justices lifted a lower court pause on the mass layoffs, which were directed in an executive order signed by President Trump in February. The order does not touch on whether the White House's federal reorganization is legal, but it allows it to fire employees from 19 federal agencies as the case proceeds. The Supreme Court recently ended its closely watched 2024 term, where some of its biggest orders came from its shadow docket.
No longer will we have rogue judges striking down President Trump's policies across the entire nation.
In one of its final high-profile decisions, the Supreme Court limited lower courts' use of what is called a universal injunction. The case concerned President Trump's executive order limiting birthright citizenship for babies born to people in the U.S. illegally or temporarily. Federal judges in three states ruled Trump's move unconstitutional and blocked the order from being enforced anywhere in the country. Justice Amy Coney Barrett and her conservative colleagues ruled that the judges overstepped their authority. Though the legal battle over birthright citizenship will continue, this ruling gave the Trump administration a major win.
There are a lot of universal injunctions that are going to have to be removed by the courts, which is going to allow many of President Trump's executive orders and other actions to go forward.
That was just one of many cases the high court considered from its shadow docket. In March, the judges directed the Trump administration to pay $2 billion in foreign aid to nonprofit groups for work they had already completed for the government. And in April, they denied the administration's bid to dismiss the legal case surrounding the deportation of Maryland migrant Kilmar Obrego-Garcia. But the court has sided with the White House on other emergency applications. That includes ending a Biden-era program that protected more than 500,000 migrants from deportation and allowing the Trump administration to deport immigrants to third-party countries. On the court's merits docket, religious freedom played a key role. An evenly split bench was unable to rule on what would have been the first Catholic charter school, leaving a lower court block in place. The court did reach majority to side with religious parents in Maryland who were refused the option to remove their children from public school lessons with LGBT-focused materials. In other closely watched cases, the court upheld Tennessee's law that bans gender transition procedures for minors, as well as a Texas law that requires pornography sites to verify the ages of its users.
States have a legitimate interest, an important government interest, in protecting children from obscene images, and that these kinds of age verification requirements really only had an incidental burden on adults' free speech rights.
To share his insights on this Supreme Court term, we are joined now by Eric Niffen. He is an attorney and fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Thanks for being with us, Eric. First, let's look at one of the court's decisions on religious freedom, Mahmoud versus Taylor. Restore the rights of parents in Montgomery County to opt their children out of public school lessons that violate their religious beliefs. Eric, does this case only affect parents in Maryland, or does it have a national impact?
This is a national case, and it's really important. Montgomery County was arguing that parents' rights, the fundamental right of parents to direct their children's education, only comes into play when the school is coercing children. And the Supreme Court says, no, that is not the right standard. And that's really important here.
That is important. And though many have criticized the decision in another case, in Trump versus CASA, for its potential impact on birthright citizenship, the case had nothing to do with the rights of unborn children, but on the lower court's use of universal injunctions. Eric, why are these injunctions so controversial?
So traditionally, in our American system, courts are there to decide cases and controversies, and that is issues between the litigants. And so that is generally the limit of what the effect of court's decisions. There has been a trend in recent years to change that, and it's really been accelerating. There were 24 universal injunctions during both the Biden and Obama presidencies over 12 years. Whereas President Trump has had 79 issued against his executive actions, and 92% of those by democratically appointed judges. Mm. So it's been a real change. The Supreme Court's decision is an effort to try to rein that back in.
Eric, we've also seen Justice Amy Coney Barrett face harsh criticism from some Republicans for what they see as breaking from her conservative colleagues in certain cases. A New York Times story wrote that she is showing signs of a leftward drift. But Eric, it was Barrett herself who authored the opinion in Trump versus CASA. Has she silenced her critics? What has this term revealed about Barrett as a justice?
I think the attacks against Justice Barrett have been unfair. I think, like her mentor, Justice Scalia, she understands her job is to apply her judicial philosophy and decide cases and not produce politically favorable outcomes. So I have not been happy with the criticisms of Justice Barrett. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm grateful that this decision has helped reassure conservatives that she is an excellent justice, and we're grateful to have her.
And what do you think, looking at this term, what do you think these decisions reveal about the dynamics of the high court right now? Both the conservative and liberal justices have written strongly worded opinions against their colleagues. Is it a sign of strained relationships on the bench, or is this standard of justices?
I wouldn't say that it's strained personal relationships. I think it's hard to say that. We do have justices with very different views of the courts and of the American project. And what the roles of judges is and the role of the Constitution. And I think these opinions reflect that. Mm-hmm. Our justices do have different views themselves. And our judiciary is the most transparent branch of the federal government. It's mm-hmm. the only one that's required to spell out in detailed written opinions why they are doing what they're doing. And so I don't think it's a bad thing for us to see that out in paper, to see here are the disagreements, here are the different views, and let them play out. Mm.
Looking ahead to the next term now, the justices are hearing a case centered around Colorado's ban on what is commonly called conversion therapy. The Christian counselor who brought on the case says the law prevents her from sharing her clients a biblical approach to gender dysphoria and same-sex attraction. As a point of clarity for our viewers, the Catholic Church does not have an official stance on the practice. But Eric, what could this case mean for religious freedom and free speech?
I think this is a really important free speech case, and it does have religious liberty implications too. We just saw a related case, United States versus Scrimeti, which dealt with Tennessee's law over banning gender transition procedures for minors. And as part of that opinion, there was discussion among the justices about, you know, the science here is not as locked down as the left would present it. Hmm. And there's a lot of concerns that get to this core question is, how should we best help as a society children who struggle with their gender identity? That's a legitimate question, and that is not a closed question. And I think that the Supreme Court will hold that there is a free speech right for counselors to pursue something with their clients other than what the dominant ideology and people at WPATH would have us do.
And finally, Eric, just last week, the High Court announced it will examine laws in Idaho and in West Virginia that ban biological males who identify as transgender from competing in women's and girls' sports. The conservative majority has shown it's receptive to laws that protect children from gender ideology. So do you anticipate they will side with these laws as well?
I do. We saw this in Scrimeti, the Supreme Court. Dealt with a similar issue and came out saying, no, these laws, that law in that case, discriminates on the basis of sex and on, not on sex, but on age and on medical procedure. And those are legitimate distinctions. There's some similar issues here. There's competing arguments about what type of discrimination is going on here. Title IX says that as a general matter, schools may not discriminate on the basis of sex, but it has certain carve-outs for bathrooms, for showers, and for sports. And I think the Supreme Court will apply that and will say that it is legitimate for schools to say that women's sports are for women and to decide that based on biology. I think that's how that case will come out. Mm.
Eric Niffen, thank you so much for sharing your insight with us, and thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Good to be with you.
You're coming to a place here, which many pilgrims did, where there are miracles, where there is a special sense and effectiveness of God.
Next, pomp, circumstance, and history. The Mother Church of England hosts its one annual Catholic Mass. We'll tell you why it was so special this year.
Finally today, EWTN News in Depth takes you to England for a once-in-a-year Catholic Mass in honor of St. Thomas Becket. On Monday, the Anglican Church opened its most prominent place of worship, Canterbury Cathedral, to Catholics in honor of Becket, a great martyr who was assassinated in the cathedral centuries ago for defending the principles of religious liberty. Reporter Colin Flynn was in Canterbury for the annual Catholic Mass.
It's something you almost never see. More than 50 Catholic priests processing down the central aisle of Canterbury Cathedral, the symbolic heart of the Church of England. A Catholic Mass celebrated at the very cathedral where the seeds of the Reformation were first sown. The occasion is the Feast of the Translation of St. Thomas Becket, commemorating the movement of his relics in 1220 and honouring his martyrdom, the ultimate sacrifice for the faith. Over 800 worshippers packed into the cathedral, the largest Catholic congregation seen here since the Reformation. And the Mass was presided over by the Apostolic Nuncio to Great Britain, representing Pope Leo XIV.
I would like to express in this emblematic place the Christian closeness of His Holiness, Pope Leo XIV.
An incredibly profound way to honour the life of St. Thomas Becket, who was killed right here centuries ago.
850 years ago, Thomas Becket was murdered inside this very cathedral. His death for his faith went on to inspire generations. And today here in Canterbury, we remember his life and his legacy.
In the 12th century, King Henry II sought to assert royal authority over the Catholic Church in England. Thomas Becket, the Catholic Archbishop of Canterbury, loyal to Rome, refused to submit. And so in 1170, four knights, thinking they were doing the king's bidding, murdered Becket at the altar of Canterbury Cathedral. His death, over 350 years before Henry VIII's break with Rome, made him one of the medieval church's most revered martyrs. The city of Canterbury, with its winding lanes and cobblestone streets, still bears witness to this Catholic past. And this year, pilgrims have been retracing those spiritual roots, starting their morning with the rosary and adoration at St. Thomas of Canterbury's Catholic Church, just a short walk from the cathedral. Elizabeth Forrester has organised this entire pilgrimage and special Mass and explains why this tradition remains so meaningful.
Canterbury itself was, in its heyday, was the third most significant site of pilgrimage in all of Christendom, after Jerusalem, Rome, came Canterbury.
Wow.
And I think it's really significant and important to invigorate and really let people know or remind people of the heritage that there is here.
That Catholic heritage runs deep. And across town at St. Dunstan's Church, another chapter of England's Catholic story is remembered. The resting place of St. Thomas More's Head, executed by Henry VIII in 1535 for refusing to accept the king's supremacy over the church.
We are ministers of the gospel. Let us not think that that can be done without a price.
It's fantastic. See how they plant.
Among those paying their respects to these martyrs was Lord Christopher Monckton of Brenchley.
Why do you think it is that St. Thomas Becket's memory, his legacy, his life is still inspiring people to this very day?
They stood out against overweening state power on behalf of ordinary folk who did not wish to be trampled upon. And they did so with the most astonishing courage and with complete disregard for their own lives. And that willingness to sacrifice their very selves, that is an inspiration to every British Catholic in particular.
As the time for Mass approached, crowds gathered outside the great cathedral doors, waiting to step inside a building originally built for the Catholic liturgy, a cathedral whose very stones were laid for this purpose.
Well, I mean, it's a fantastic occasion to be able to celebrate the Roman Catholic Mass here in this magnificent cathedral, the heart cathedral of the Anglican denomination. It's a great occasion.
I just want to be part of this solemn celebration and experience the choir and everything in the church.
With the church overflowing, the sound of the organ rang out. And after Holy Communion, the voices of the choir filled the air, St. Thomas Becket was not the first to die for the Catholic faith in England, and he would not be the last. But 850 years after his martyrdom, despite the Reformation, despite the centuries of division, Catholics gathered here once again to mark his life and sacrifice and to celebrate the Holy Mass in a very special way. At Canterbury Cathedral in the United Kingdom, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
And that's it for this week's edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.